If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What does motion sound like? With Kizikans free shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks. And welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today's podcast features a conversation with historian Andrew Roberts. Andrew is the author of several history books, including biographies of Napoleon and Churchill. His latest book, Leadership in War, Essential Lessons from Those Who Made History, compares 9 major figures from modern history to explore whether there are any traits or characteristics that make a leader successful during conflict. Our digital editor, Emma Mason, met Andrew in London to find out more.
So perhaps you could just run us through initially what inspired you to write the book.
When I was sitting my entrance exam for university back in 1981, you had to do a 3-hour paper on one sentence. And the question that I remember was, how does one person lead 100? And I can't even remember whether or not that was the one I chose to write about, but it's always stuck in my mind, that question. And of course, when it comes to military history, you don't think about just 100, but you think about 1 million or 100 million, or in China and India's case, 1 billion people. How do you lead? And so when I was asked to do a series of lectures for the New York Historical Society, by the Lerman Institute, I was prompted really to look at that question and to ask myself that question. And it was a series of 10 lectures, so I chose 9 leaders, war leaders, and tried to see what was what they had in common and what divided them and their differences. And it struck me very powerfully by the time that I'd given the 9th lecture, that they had an awful lot more in common than divided them. Even people like Adolf Hitler, who obviously seems to have nothing in common whatsoever with democratic and civilized leaders, has certain sort of tricks of the trade, certain techniques of war leadership. And so my primary motivation really for this book was to investigate that phenomenon.
Fantastic. And how did you go about selecting those leaders? Was it all related to the lectures you'd given? Or
yes, the lectures that I gave over 3 years were just about people who interested me, frankly. They had to be war leaders. That was the prerequisite. But other than that, I could choose anybody I liked. I was writing and interested in Winston Churchill at the time. I wrote a big book, Churchill, Walking with Destiny. And so Churchill was always going to be one of them. And of course, that also did draw me towards the Second World War and Second World War leaders, of whom there are an awful lot. But I'd also written a book about Napoleon, and so the Napoleonic Wars was important and interesting to me. And I knew Margaret Thatcher. She appointed me to take her place in the Margaret Thatcher Archive Trust. And her war leadership in the Falklands was something that I remembered as a young man. And so I wanted to look at that as well. So I have to say it's complete serendipity, frankly. I can't claim. People have already asked me, why isn't George Washington there and why isn't Abraham Lincoln there? Just simply because I was writing about the people who were interesting me at that time.
And what qualities did you find they had in common?
Well, it's very interesting, what they don't have in common that you think they might. Charisma, for example, is a almost entirely artificial construct. It's something that people can create. Adolf Hitler himself was not in the slightest bit charismatic, but once you have Leni Riefenstahl doing your movies and Albert Speer doing your rallies and Joseph Goebbels in complete control of all of the propaganda in the Reich, and nobody being able to contradict him, you can create a charisma. And so nobody's born charismatic. And so I found that that charisma actually wasn't something that all of these leaders necessarily had in common. Neither was a sense of humour. There are lots of people, Margaret Thatcher, the classic example, which you'd meet her at a drinks party and she'd start with, as her small talk would be, "So how do you think NATO is going, Andrew?" Which would be always extremely off-putting, but nonetheless, a sense of humour isn't necessary, or small talk. Neither really is having a good character. And there are plenty of adulterers in this group. There are plenty of people who certainly wouldn't want to spend any time with at all, really. But the things that they do have in common, and this became more and more strong as I continued through the lecture series, was a powerful moment, usually in early adolescence, where their ideology became fixed. And it was often because of some important outside element, something that was going on in the world that affected them and created their assumptions, their global assumptions. And then in their mid to late 20s, usually, not always, in Adolf Hitler's case, it was a little bit later than that, but usually they have a powerful moment when they recognise their own capabilities, their capacity for leadership, their capacity for doing something impressive or extraordinary. And I came across this so many times that I believe that it couldn't just simply be a coincidence. Now, I accept, of course, that this is true of leaders in other spheres, leaders in business, leaders in politics, as opposed to just war leaders. But because I was a military historian, I decided to concentrate on war leaders.
One of the themes that you explore in the book, obviously, is self-belief, and that many of them had this sense of destiny, that Dick Churchill, when he was a teenager, I'm destined to save the nation. Can you talk us a little bit more through that?
Yes, it's a very important aspect. I don't think you can understand Winston Churchill unless you appreciate this driving force of personal destiny that he, that sense of personal destiny that he had. When Churchill became Prime Minister in May 1940, he wrote of that moment later in his war memoirs, "I felt as if I were walking with destiny and that all my past life had been but a preparation for this hour and for this trial." And this sense of destiny was something that he really had ever since he was a 16-year-old schoolboy at Harrow. He told his best friend, Merland Evans, the lad was called, that there shall be great upheavals and great struggles in our lives, and that I shall be called upon to save England and save London and save the Empire. And he believed this for the rest of his life, and it allowed him in the great crises, the greatest crises of our history, to stay extraordinarily calm and to keep a very good sense sense of humour and to encourage his entourage and parliament and the press and the people, because he absolutely believed in himself.
This was a theme you found through with all the nine leaders.
I'm not sure Margaret Thatcher was felt that she had a sense of destiny, but you're right. I mean, overall, I think it is a very powerful thing. When Adolf Hitler survived, and this is why a sense of destiny isn't necessarily always a good thing, when Adolf Hitler survived his the bomb plot of the 20th of July 1944, he put it down to Providence being the reason that he survived that that plot. Napoleon, of course, had a very powerful sense of his own star, of following his star. So yes, I think it is. Now, the interesting thing is, of course, for most of us, if you or I said that we had a sense of destiny, it would be a clear case of psychological disorder. So, you know, in most people, it's a fairly sort of weird thing to have. But when you do get to the top and you do make become a great leader, it obviously is a not necessarily a prerequisite, but something that can be seen again and again throughout history.
And am I right in thinking it was Napoleon that said, "I am, without irony, I am the new Caesar"?
Yes, yes, absolutely. And he very much thought of himself as the new Caesar all his life. Even after he'd lost, which, of course, Caesar never did on the battlefield, he, when the was creating institutions of France, the Senate, of course, the Empire himself, making himself emperor, you look at all the various bits of symbolism that he used with the laurel leaf crown and so on. It's a very straightforward, the architecture also a throwback to classical architecture. It's a very straightforward statement that that he is the new Caesar. Again, this was obviously hubristic to a degree because his empire lasted 13 years rather than thousands, but nonetheless, it was something he profoundly believed. And he had his moments very much of the moment of self-belief. It was when he was 26 years old at the Battle of Lodi, as it's also pronounced, and he recognised after victory in that battle in Italy that he had what it took, not just to be a great commander, but to be a great man, and said so.
And that sense of history was very important, wasn't it? You say in the book that they each, you know, like, for example, Thatcher was inspired hearing Churchill's speeches on the Blitz, the Battle of Britain. Churchill, in turn, was inspired by Napoleon.
Yes, that's right. Yes, yes, and Napoleon was inspired by Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar. Yes, there is a sort of apostolic succession almost between these leaders and the way in which they in turn inspire each other. And actually, reading is another one. An interest in history is another thing that they have together. Study history, Churchill said to a young American in the coronation, at the time of the coronation, the luncheon, in fact, of the coronation. He said, study history, for therein lie all the secrets of statecraft. And many of these people, Hitler, it was his favourite subject at school. Napoleon read voraciously in his school library. The studying of history, this was also true, actually, of military history of George Marshall and Dwight Eisenhower, is a very important aspect of leadership.
You mentioned there writing and the ability to produce good literature. Obviously, Churchill was obviously renowned for this. But I was so fascinated to read in your chapter about Hitler, how Mein Kampf was just incredibly dull. There's barely a notable sentence to pluck from it.
Yes, I think it has to be up there with Das Kapital as the most boring book ever written by somebody who was as influential as Karl Marx or Adolf Hitler. It actually is also slightly misleading in that it's a book about attacking in the East, where of course he actually attacked in the West, and only when he'd been victorious in the West was he able to attack in the East. Had Stalin mastered it properly, he'd have never signed the Nazi-Soviet pact, but nonetheless, Stalin, as I try and point out in the book, made mistake after mistake when it came to his interaction with the Germans. It is important to read a lot. Needless to say, I hardly need to say that to the BBC History magazine. But nonetheless, I don't think any of the leaders, the nine leaders I chose, was uninterested in the past.
And conversely, there, I was very interested that you said that it wasn't necessarily vital for them to be great public speakers.
No. Several of them were not great orators. Many of them were, of course. Churchill, again, we go back to. Adolf Hitler, in his own way, was a mesmerising public speaker. That was part of the problem, really. I don't think that that can be said. It certainly can't be said of Stalin or Napoleon, neither of whom were particularly good. So, yes, you'd imagine that being an orator is a prerequisite, but actually it turned out not to be.
Many of them workaholics, Thatcher notably.
Yes, putting in a lot of hours in the day. Again, Hitler is is different here. Hitler was pretty lazy. In fact, he didn't like getting up early. He took long walks and basically enjoyed to have tea and would stop during the day. He enjoyed watching his lieutenants working hard, and he would set them up against each other, in fact, in a deliberate way. Sort of survival of the fittest kind of thing. But the rest of them were workaholics. Napoleon would have a 16-hour day. The reason that Churchill had his naps was that he believed that he could squeeze an extra 2 hours out of the day at the end. He was joined by other famous workaholics like Eisenhower and George C. Marshall, who thought nothing of 16, 18-hour days. Yes, I think when you're at the absolute peak like this, you by and large have to work hard. Stalin worked hard as well, in fact.
You identify in the book that many of the leaders had a sixth sense for politics.
Yes, they did. They were, in the democratic sense, those ones who were democratic leaders were just very good at getting their messages across, not necessarily through great speeches I mentioned earlier, but through orders of the day or through proclamations or through the press. They have a real ability to make clear, really, all their listeners knew what they were trying to say. And that's important, again, not just in war leadership, of course, that's also important in business leadership and political leadership in general. But particularly it is true in war leadership, because when you're asking people to risk their lives on a daily basis, you have to enthuse them. And as Napoleon said at one point, you must speak to the soul. It's the thing that electrifies the men.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
But when he became leader of the Nazi Party in 1921, he recognised that he was an orator who could transfix people. That was how this personality was able to lead his country down the road to disaster.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
And you say in the book also on that theme that it was so important that many of the leaders had a real intuitive understanding of what their civilians and soldiers wanted, what made them tick, what resonated with them. And for example, like you remember you saying that Napoleon took a lot of time to spend time with his men, to actually have a democratic sort of process in place.
Yes, yes, it was a democratic process with very much a small D, because they weren't going to get the vote.
Of course,
he was not going to allow himself to be sort of outnumbered or outmaneuvered by people in that sense. But he had a way with the men. You know, he would always ensure that the drummer boy was invited to sit around the campfire and was allowed a glass of wine, and he made sure that the wine went out to his sentries, and little things like that that of course altered just made people love him. And it's true of a great deal of these leaders. Eisenhower was his breezy, sunny, optimistic disposition was something that that people very much liked seeing. They're really, I suppose, again, it's something that that politicians, the good politicians, should have. The surprising thing is how many of them don't, in fact. But in war leadership, that capacity to connect with the troops is something very special. And Napoleon definitely had it also in that he would sometimes be rude about his own officers in front of the men if they weren't providing the creature comforts that the men needed.
And that ability to empathise as well, I saw you noted in the book that was possibly more important than, say, a military background.
Yes, I mean, there are several people in this list who don't have any military background at all. And to be a successful war leader with no military background, you do have to have built up this sort of trust with the people. So long as you are going in a direction that seems to promise ultimate victory, people will put up with an enormous amount. It's interesting, it's the direction of travel that seems to matter more than the individual individual battles. And if there seems to be a way towards ultimate victory, people will go through hell.
And how much do you think luck played a role in the success of these various leaders?
Well, famously, of course, Napoleon said that he wanted his generals to be lucky. He chose his generals on the basis of their luckiness, which is an extraordinary thing to say, really, when one considers all the various other attributes that somebody has to have to insist on them. But being lucky as well is a difficult one. But I don't know. You see it again and again. Charles de Gaulle was captured several times, and that people thought in the First World War that he was dead, you know, on several occasions, and he wasn't. He was a tremendously lucky politician. There was a good deal of luck actually needed in the Falklands War with regard to the weather and so on. You know, whether some of those extra exocets got down there, whether or not they were used successfully. It could have gone either way, that war. In fact, the more we know about it, the more lucky Margaret Thatcher seems. It's not a It's not a thing that historians can terribly easily quantify, obviously, luck, but it's there, and there's no getting around it.
And another thing you mentioned was this idea of myth and image creation. Maybe you could talk us through what you meant by that.
The most successful war leaders were able to make myths and legends whilst still leading, turn themselves into living legends. And you see this very strongly with Stalin during the Second World War, where people, ordinary Russians, they felt they knew him, even though, of course, the actual personal interaction was minute, not least because he stayed very much in his dacha and in the Kremlin for 99% of the war. There was a sense that your leader is somebody who is almost superhuman. Hitler, of course, was somebody who constantly tried to present himself as an Aryan Superman. But actually, when you look at the kind of things he was saying to his entourage, they are extremely sort of nutty. An awful lot of them, just very, very weird stuff, frankly. And I quote quite extensively in this book from his table talk, which is a bit of a tainted source, because there have been people that say that that Martin Bormann, who was the Nazi party secretary, was taking everything down. Didn't take down everything that that the Führer was saying, but I don't think there's any indication that he actually made anything up or that he exaggerated wildly, and yet you have Hitler just coming up with just theory after theory that seems to bear absolutely no resemblance to any kind of logic or reason. He believed he knew what dogs were thinking. He believed that he could tell that Czechs were Mongolian because of the shape of their moustaches. He believed that Franklin Roosevelt was Jewish. He had all sorts of, there was a list of these weird beliefs that he came up with in this book, which I think will surprise and shock and on occasion amuse readers.
Maybe you could just talk us through how he managed to influence so many, given his limitations.
Well, that's right. I mean, these extraordinary personal limitations. But at the same time, he was talking to people who felt that they'd been stabbed in the back, who felt terrible resentment against capitalism and against the West for the 1920s and what they had to undergo after the First World War, who were certain of their greatness, and the Germans are a great people and always have been a great people, but they saw the way in which the Versailles Treaty kept them constrained, and they were willing to go along with pretty much anything that was going to get them out of that situation. And it's one of the great tragedies, obviously, of the history of mankind, that the person who rose up from the gutter to lead them was somebody as fanatical as and bigoted as Adolf Hitler. It's a story that has been told many, many times, of course. But I think that what I've tried to do in this is to fit him into a group of other leaders, Stalin, of course, also being a totalitarian monster, but the others being much more civilized human beings, and to try to draw out those leadership qualities that he had, and see them really beyond the moral, as it were. It was not an easy thing to do.
And I was fascinated that you described him as really quite a boring, well, at one point you say he was a soulless little weirdo, just a very strange, somebody that you wouldn't avoid in the street, you would just pass in the street.
That's right.
Unremarkable.
Yes, that's right. I do believe that, and the more that one reads of his table talk, the more one recognizes that period when he was on the streets, living in down and out shelters between 1909 and 1914 in Vienna, those 5 years, where he was exposed to a great deal of anti-Semitic literature and to all the horrors of anyone living on the street, really must have affected his soul in the most appallingly dark way. And you see also, of course, with him that and his key moment, I mentioned earlier about how people have these key moments when they know that they're capable of leadership. And his came in 1919 and 20, up to 1923, really, where, at the time of the Birkel Putsch. But when he became leader of the Nazi Party in 1921... he recognised, because of these speeches that he gave in beer halls in Munich, that he was an orator who could transfix people. And it was that was how he, this personality who is essentially a complete nullity of a human being, was able to lead his country down the road to disaster.
And you mentioned Stalin there. I was fascinated to read that you said that actually his leadership was actually perhaps more akin to, say, someone like Churchill's rather than...
Yes, he started off the war, as you'd imagine, as the classic totalitarian dictator, insisting on being in control of everything, like Hitler did. But unlike Hitler, during the war, and especially, of course, after he suffered something akin to a mental breakdown after the Operation Barbarossa on the 22nd of June 1941, when Hitler invaded Russia, he started to move over and to give much more autonomy to marshals of the Soviet Union, who really understood grand strategy so much better than him, people like Konev and Zhukov and Rokossovsky. And as a result, actually did far better. He chaired the Stavka committees, but he didn't believe that he was right all along. Whereas at the Wolfschanze, Hitler would sit there and or stand there more likely and listen to generals who knew far better than he about strategy. The people who had been to staff college when he had just been a regimental runner in the First World War, and were and yet he'd go back at the end of the... he'd listen with respect to these people. And then at the end of a very long meeting, he'd go back to saying precisely what he'd originally said right at the beginning, maybe an hour earlier.
Staying with Stalin for a moment, you say that Roosevelt and Churchill effectively sort of underestimated him because he wasn't a sort of typical dictator stereotype. He was well-spoken, well-organised, not without humour.
That's right. And they rather... it's a terrible thing to say of democratic leaders, but in the Potsdam Conference in 1945, Churchill actually told Anton Eden about Stalin, "I like that man." Now, this is a terrible thing, really, and it's very difficult as a biographer of Churchill to see this because and to deal with it because how could he possibly like somebody who he knew in the 1930s had organised deliberate artificial famines in Ukraine that killed millions? He had very soon after the Katyn massacre, Churchill had found out about it and knew that it was Stalin who had killed 20 plus thousand Poles in the Katyn forest. And elsewhere, and yet he was still able to say, I like that man. And then at the Yalta conference, of course, he also, although he had very few alternatives at that stage, he actually trusted him when Stalin promised Poland its integrity and independence. So there is a sort of moral issue here. Now, the way that, of course, I think ultimately one must see it is that for every five Germans killed in the Second World War, by which I mean... died on a battlefield as opposed to being bombed from the air in the strategic bombing offensive. But for every five soldiers killed on a battlefield, four of them died on the Eastern Front. So it was essential for Hitler... essential for Churchill to get on with Stalin. And I'm afraid there'd seem no alternative.
One of the other leaders I wanted to ask you about was Nelson. You say in your book that biographers really need to get their priorities right when it comes to assessing Nelson. What did you mean by that?
Well, they talk about his personality and the drawbacks to his personality, and there are several. He was a very vain man. He was a pretty bigoted when it came to the French. I mean, obsessively so. And he was somebody who his belief was constant attack, always be on the offensive, and he did it absolutely brilliantly. But his personality and the problems with it, and of course his affair with Emma Hamilton, seem to have distracted a lot of biographers who fail to appreciate that we also have certainly one of the greatest military figures in the history of warfare. The extraordinary capacity he had for attack was something that was utterly single-minded, and maybe you needed to be that fanatical in order to pull off the victories that Nelson did. So yes, I think the priority should be greatest admiral in the history of the Royal Navy, but beyond that as well. I mean, lots of people would put him up as one of the greatest admirals of all time, and the worries about whether or not he was obsessed with getting peerages and knighthoods and things like that has to be put to one side. That was just something that everyone was obsessed with in the 18th century.
And his death, you said that in a book, there was no such public outpouring of raw emotion until the death of Diana in 97.
That's right, yes. Even Queen Victoria, for example, I mean, of course, the people were much more stiff upper-lipped in the Victorian period than they were in the Regency period, or as we discovered at the time of the death of Lady Diana. But it was a massive outpouring of emotion. Actually, all of the admirals who carried Nelson's coffin were in tears in St. Paul's Cathedral, which is an extraordinary thought. One would be rather surprised if that was the case today.
So, having looked at all these leaders in depth, who do you feel was the greatest?
I think that's a very good question, Emma. I'm going to, if I may, just read out the last part of the last paragraph of Napoleon, the essay on Napoleon, where I say, because I think the reason I want to do this is that it sums up lots of the leadership qualities necessary, and I think it answers your question. Napoleon's career demonstrated the importance of compartmentalization, meticulous planning, knowledge of terrain, superb timing, steady nerves, valuing the importance of discipline and training, understanding the psychology of the ordinary soldier to create esprit de corps, the issuing of inspirational speeches and proclamations, controlling the news, adapting the tactical ideas of others, asking pertinent questions of the right people, a deep learning and appreciation of history, a formidable memory, utter ruthlessness when necessary, the deployment of personal charisma, immense calm under unimaginable pressure, especially in moments that look like defeat, an almost obsessive compulsive attention to detail, rigorous control of emotions, and the ability to exploit a momentary numerical advantage at the decisive point on the battlefield, and, not least, good luck. Even though he was ultimately defeated, Napoleon is the wartime leader against whom all the others must be judged.
That was Andrew Roberts. His book, Leadership in War, Essential Lessons from Those Who Made History, is out now, published by Allen Lane. Andrew also wrote a feature for BBC History magazine about the lessons that leaders have learnt from the past. You can read that on our website at historyextra.com/war-leaders. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back on Wednesday when Sinclair Mackay will be discussing the bombing of Dresden in 1945.